die, Father, is nothing less. Ever since I was a child, I had a feeling that something is missing me. I want to know why I'm here. Can any of us know that?
Become yourself. Name God and the devil don't matter.
I want to learn. I want to understand. Be careful. Can you find the force to enable these two quite opposite lives to live together in yourself? At any moment, the wolf can devour the lamb.
And you must learn what it means to become responsible.
This is an exact science. And that is why you are here.
And before known history, to the unknown future, this is Red Ice Radio. For the Seeker.
I must strive to know.
And welcome back, everybody. This is Henrik. I'm happy to have you with us once again. If you've been listening since the beginning of this year, you know that we've been doing a series with Olle Damegård about the assassination of Swedish Prime Minister Olof Palme and the larger connections to corruptions and cover-ups around the world. His book is Coup d'etat in slow motion, and today we are going to do the fourth and last part in our series. In this installment, Olle will take the entire story to a new level, so if you have not heard the first three programs, please stop this one right now, and then go to redicecreations.com, click into our radio archive, scroll down to January 2013 and listen to the series from the beginning. It will be worth it, trust me. We've done one program every month so far, and in those 6 hours, you'll get the entire background story, both on Olle, his work, and the various theories that we've been going through so far. We'll do a brief summary right here in the beginning, and then we'll dive right into the deep end of the pool. All right. Hi, Olle. Welcome back. This has been such an exciting and, of course, knowledgeable series so far, and I'm really looking forward to this part four, our last part in the series. And I know that there are many others as well who are eager to hear, your final thoughts, if you will, and ideas and what you've pulled together for this last one. So I'm certainly looking forward to it. Welcome back, Olle. Good to talk to you again.
Thank you so much, Henrik. It's been a pleasure.
Excellent. You bet, definitely. Everything okay with you today?
Yeah, I'm very blessed, thank you.
Excellent. Now, where would you like to begin for this last part? We have some shockers and a lot of stuff to get to, of course, in this part that's going to tie a lot of this together. Where do you think we should begin, Olle, this time?
I just wanted to say that during these, I don't know if it's 6-7 hours I've been here on Red Ice Radio, I hope that I build a foundation for my credibility, since what I will present today is quite mind-blowing, to say the least. And once again, there's no harm meant to anyone. This is just my utmost intention is to connect all the dots in the best possible way to be able to solve this mystery once and for all. And I know that what I'm going to say today is going to be difficult for many people to believe, but please hear me out first, and then you can make up your own mind. What I would like to is to start with to just look back and see what we've gone through, just a quick overview of what we've been going through these first three parts. And listeners who have been following, they might remember that when Olof Palme was assassinated this late evening in February 1986, right away, there were so many strange things happening. There were delayed alerts to the radio, to the police cars. The whole chase of the assassin was delayed with hours and hours. There were thousands and thousands of very strange circumstances pointing to right-wing elements within the police and as well as the investigation. There's also very strange relationships between the people who have been accused of being part of the assassination and people in the investigation itself. where they turn up as friends and partners of the same shooting clubs and so on. It's also, there's several totally innocent patsies that have been accused of this, and some has died in very strange circumstances. At least one of them had been murdered, the so-called 33-year-old who was shot dead in the States, and also the favorite patsy of them all for most people, Christer Pettersson, who died under very strange circumstances. He was found outside a hospital with his skull cracked in a way that looks very much like somebody had hit him with something very hard in the head. But this was, like so many other things, just dismissed as an accident. We have strange policemen popping up in different roles, many often in different parts of the whole conspiracy, taking different parts in different, and in odd places as well. Then we have the Palme family. There's so many questions around this family, around Lisbeth Palme, the wife of Olof Palme, that is said to have been shot at as well, where the coat that it's claimed that she had on when she was shot and has also been presented as evidence with bullet holes in and so on, is not the same coat that she had on when she was, there was a photo taken of her when she was rushing into the hospital, meaning that it was not the same coat. Also, the bullets that were found on the side of the assassination were found in very strange locations and totally pristine, no damage to them, more or less. There's also strange things around Morten Palme, the son that they went to the cinema with, because the times doesn't fit in when he was when it said that Lisbeth Palme called him from the hospital home. At that time, he was somewhere else. He was already in their apartment in Gamla Stan, where he had officially nothing to do there. But he claims that he went there because when he was called, he thought that, and he was told that his dad had been shot, he thought that they had driven him home to the apartment instead of taking him to the hospital. That is his explanation. But the times don't fit in, like many other times in the whole thing. The times doesn't fit together. We have the autopsy, where there's absolutely no photos. It was released after heavy pressure from private investigators for over, I think, 8 years. And when it was finally released, it was heavily censored. There's more or less half of it is just covered with black ink. There's a death certificate where the address of the prime minister is an address that doesn't even exist. There's lots of documents and evidence that has been manipulated and tampered with. There are tape recordings from during the night, the radio communication between the ambulances and the police cars and so on. Lots of it have been cut to pieces and put together again, then burnt, then discovered, then burnt again, tampered with. They put in some calls that were very clearly fake. They put in, mixed in with the other ones, just making it all a massive big mess, all of it. We have strange suicides, we have murders, quite a few murders of people involved, also some witnesses. There are some people who have known things and so on that have been involved in very strange accidents, and like I said, suicides and so on. There are also connections to everything from pedophile gangs to the Bofors Helva, the big scandal with the arms factory in Sweden, where there's been lots of illegal weapons being transported from Sweden in and out of different countries, going to war, countries involved in war, also with strong connections to the Iran-Contra scandal. We have even connections way back to the JFK assassination, where people that were involved there in, like I told in the last chapter about the Operation 40, people that were part of the assassination team in Dallas were actually more or less indirectly part, one of them, part in the assassination in Stockholm so many years later. And this little small group of professional assassins had turned up in so many of the big conspiracies around the world over the years. Everything from the assassination of John Lennon, Che Guevara, the overthrow of Allende and the murder of him as well. There's so many of them. Then we have the strange location of the assassination as well. It was right outside the Skandia building. Skandia is an insurance company, but at the same time, it was the cover for the Stay Behind headquarters for many years, where Olof Palme was involved in building it up over several years. And Stay Behind, for those people who don't know it, is a ghost army built up by NATO, consisting of, for instance, in Sweden, it's all the countries that are part of NATO. Part of joining NATO is to build up their own ghost army, of consisting of small cells of 8 to 10 people, with radio communication, arms, fuel, all of these things, depots buried everywhere, so that these countries would be prepared should an invasion come from the east. That was when it was built up to start with, before or just after the Second World War. That was.
And by the way, I mean, just to mention that as well, Sweden has not been a member officially of NATO, but that's obviously laughable. And of course, there's been NATO activity in this country for many years. So
very, very good point you made there. And that is why they had to do it differently in Sweden. And the former chief of CIA, Bill Colby, William Colby, he was the one before he became so high up in CIA, but he was sent to Sweden to build it up together with Olof Palme and other people.
Yeah,
but exactly like you say, it's a scandal. I must say, a scandal that Sweden is part of this, since they have never been officially part of NATO. Then we have since I'm going to come into this area, we have had some strange sex scandals surrounding the Swedish top layer of politicians and so on. We got the, I don't know what you would call that, Bordellhärvan, the brothel scandal.
Yeah, the Geijer affair, like the Lennart Geijer was one of the big guys involved in that.
That's
some, we have a couple of articles actually about that on the website that I'm going to link up that people can read more about. But it's definitely a it's in regards to sex with underaged children that they had at this bordello, and a lot of these high profile Swedish politicians and people within police, etc., were visiting this. And the reason why it got investigated is because it was a potential, you know, security breach, basically, because these people, they talk and everything, and there was a potential, or is this a KGB kind of run operation? Is it CIA? What is it? You know, so that's why it was investigated and looked into, I believe.
Yeah, and this is it's coming forward now more and more in different countries now, with a big scandal in England and so on. It seems like most Western countries, Western European countries, have had similar network where people on a high political level and other
entertainment
positions as well have been taking part of these. That's been part of the sort of part of the good thing with being on that level, in their point of view, is to take part of these sex parties and having free access to kids and underaged and prostitutes and whatever.
Yep.
Then after the assassination, to start with, it seemed like everything was working out the way it should, that the Swedish police involved were totally honest, and that it was a lone crazy guy that had committed it. But then the longer it went, the more and more question marks started popping up. And over the years, these have mounted up to thousands and thousands of very, very strange circumstances, that these pieces of this massive jigsaw puzzle, they do not fit together, because you always end up with a big question mark. But what I'm going to present today is, in my opinion, a way that will connect all these dots, and suddenly they will make sense. Also, after Olof Palme was assassinated, there's been quite a few people in a high position that have been saying very odd things. Like, for instance, Hans Holmér, who was the chief investigator, he said very early in August, just 6 months after the assassination, he said that if the real truth of the assassination would ever be revealed, it would shake Sweden in its foundation.
Yeah.
What does a statement like that say? For one thing, it says that he knows the truth.
And he's concealing it.
The second is that he's concealing it. And the third is that the truth is so... it's so shocking that how can it shake a country and its foundation? It must be something massive, not like an alcoholic that just went up and shot him, not like a small group of right-wing police men that did sort of like a small coup d'etat and shot the prime minister. It must be something way, way bigger, and therefore also something that should be covered up by any means and at any price, which is also what we have seen. The cover-up from the official point of view have been absolutely massive over the years. They've spent, I think it's over 1 billion Swedish krona now for the so-called investigation and all of these things. People that the Swedish taxpayers have had to pay. So
yeah.
It is a massive scandal. Then there's a policeman in an interview, and he just sort of coincidentally said, well, Olof Palme shouldn't have died that day. Okay,
mm-hmm.
It's a bit odd. Then you have the ambassador called Lidbom, which is one of the key people in this whole cover-up and assassination, if you ask me, which I will come to more later. His name was Carl Lidbom. He said, the best thing for everyone involved is that the truth is never known. Once again, to say a thing like that, you need to know the truth, and you need to know what the truth is so that you can come up with a thing like this.
And was this in interviews or papers he was quoted saying this?
Yeah, and he was also, as far as I remember, he was quoted to a paper, but also at a dinner party,
I
remember right.
Yeah, because if it's in a paper, it's just amazing that there's no follow-up question to that by the journalist.
Yeah,
do you mean? Can you explain that, please?
Yeah, but this happens again and again, that something is revealed,
yeah,
and then there's no follow-up question. Because the obvious question is like, what the hell do you mean?
Yeah, what do you know?
But there's nothing.
Yeah, amazing.
Okay, then one of Palme's near associates, he said in a TV interview when he was talking about something else, he said that while we were preparing for the funeral, we weren't even certain that he was dead. Once again, like, what did he say? You know, and this was, the funeral were arranged for people, statesmen from all over the world. There were hundreds of them. I mean, we're talking about a massive funeral with all of these guests everywhere, and then they're not even sure if he's dead. Then you got Anders Färm, who was a close associate to Olof Palme during many years. He said also, the Swedish people are not ready to hear the truth. This was in 2004, I think. I have no doubt about the killer's identity, but maybe I shouldn't mention his name. If he had thought it would be Christer Pettersson, he would have used a trumpet to blow it out. You know, it's like...
Sure.
So what are we looking at here, you know? And also, it's very strange because officially, Olof Palme is one of the most famous Swedes ever. You know, you got Greta Garbo and Roxette and so on, but Olof Palme is somebody everybody knows.
Right.
Why are there no museums? Why are there no statues? Why are there no nothing?
Just a couple of streets, as far as I know, are named after him.
There are, yeah, it's a tiny little one. But if you go abroad, there's lots more. You know, there are the big plazas, there's big buildings, museums, all of these things. But in Sweden, no. And every time you start digging into what seems to be the truth, or you go around the official version and you start looking for what actually happened, you are met by this massive machine that is just saying no, no, no. It's like you're up against a wall.
Yeah.
And if you keep pushing, you will end up either with your reputation totally devastated, or like some people have even ended up dead.
Yeah.
You know, their careers have been destroyed. So there is something that is very, very important to hide. And it's the secret is very, very big. And so this is, the stage is set now.
So where do we go from here, Ulla? let's get to the big theory and let's get it out there. And if you need to preface this a little bit, of course, you can do that. If you want to, talk about the circumstances, or you know, we've talked about the doctor before and some of that stuff as well. And maybe if there's sicknesses tied to this and whatnot. But let's get to it.
Okay. The thing is that to understand this is that you also have to understand that. In my opinion, and many other investigators as well, is that when you look into the life of Olof Palme, you soon start to see that he was playing at least a double role. One was that he was outwards the protector of the weak and poor, you know, taking countries like weak countries like Cuba and Nicaragua and all of these countries under his wings, standing up against the big evil, the USA. But at the same time, he was a member of the banking elite, the global elite. He was a Bilderberg member, and he was also a member of the Committee of 300, which is a very, very strong, more or less secret order that works on bringing together all the banking system into one.
Now, when you said as well, I just want to see if you've found any other external evidence beyond John Coleman's work to confirm the Committee of 300. Have you done that in your work, Ulla?
No, there's very many investigators who have looked into it. I have not. I have just been, when you start looking at the members in this group, it's really mind-boggling. And I think when you see, like, you got David Rockefeller, you got so many royalties. You had Olof Palme as well. And one of the latest members is Stefano Della Chiaia, who was actually part of the assassination. If you go back a few chapters and when we listened to it, he was called the what do you call that in English? Terrorfürsten.
The reign of terror, or like the terror
like
master
that.
Or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah. And this guy is unbelievable when it comes to false flag operation and terror acts in many different countries. He's like a dictionary. He's involved in so many of them. And he also admitted being part of the Palme assassination. He admitted that to his lawyer.
Mm.
That later came out to the knowledge of the Swedish investigation, who went down there to interview him. Then the lawyer suddenly died. And when they talked to him, he totally denied everything. But he is very much connected with Michael Townley and other of these people.
Yeah.
Anyway, so we have a Swedish prime minister here who is playing a double role, because his real loyalty was to the banking elite. That is what it shows when you look from the outside. He was doing something on stage to take care of to be a social democrat and to work for justice. And at the same time, behind the scene, he was working for this elite group.
He's a manufactured hero. He's a creation for the masses, basically, to project everything on as the savior, in a way.
I think, you know, like if you look at Obama, you got a similar thing there.
Sure.
And
yeah.
And quite a few, I must say, of politicians, if many, many in high positions today are connected to these groups. Not officially, they're standing there on stage saying all of these beautiful things that people want to hear. But when you look into it, they are members of the Bilderberg Group or the Council of Foreign Relations or the Committee of 300 or the Trilateral Commission and so on. And if they are part of that, these are people I would not advise to trust, because when you look at the agenda, something totally different than the official story is going on.
Well, this is, I want to break from the flow here, Ulla, but this is commonplace. I don't understand how people can't see this when it comes to politicians. They're there to satisfy the need to get people to just hear what they want to hear. And all these, across the spectrum, you know, from conservatives to socialists and what have you, they're all very, very naive. That doesn't understand how this game is being played and how mankind is being used for this purpose. So I don't get it, but there you have it.
No, but Henrik, it's thanks to programs like this and people investigating journalists who have not given up, and people like myself who have just spent so many years of digging into these things, that this is coming up to the surface. Because it's not long ago that this was absolutely on her. Nobody had heard of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. David Icke filled the stadium, what do you call it, the big stadium in London.
Wembley?
The Wembley Stadium, at least part of it. But when I met him the first time in the late 80s, there was like 82 people.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so people have really started waking up to it. And also through the internet, the awakening goes so fast. And also, I think that's why they're speeding it up with all these false flag operations. Now, the latest one with the Boston thing, I mean, it's just, come on, one again.
Yeah.
It's so poorly done. And they even use actors, you know, and they use the same. They haven't got the imagination to use different actors, but they use the same actors. Sandy Hook and the Batman, and it's sort of like very not professional.
And it's a sleight of hand as well. It's a diversion where a lot of other things are going on at the same time, both beneath the surface, but also even out in the open, really, with you know, cis spies being pushed in. And it's an opportunity to basically, you know, have a big event where everybody's attention is focused on. And that's why it's important to also look around and see what's going on in the rest of the world as these, you know, fake events are you know, all over the mainstream. Yeah.
I think what you're saying now is so, so important and so true. It's like with a magician, you know, he does something with his left hand, but the hand you should check out is the right.
Yeah.
You know, everybody's looking at the hand where you think it's happening, but it's actually somewhere else. And especially like when a bomb goes off, everybody looks that way. What happened the other way? You know,
that's
also
right.
Look in the newspapers, look at something like this happens. Boom, everybody starts writing about this, or Bill Clinton getting a blowjob or whatever. But it distracts attention away from what, and it's so purposely made to divert the attention so that people will not see what was actually happening.
Yeah.
So, well, there you go.
You're right. All right. So back to Parliament.
Back to Parliament. The thing is, he was killed in late February 1986. But already in about 6-7 months before that, he started acting very, very strangely. His colleagues and friends and so on said that he started become very distracted. It was like he lost his interest in politics. He wasn't really there when they had meetings. He was quite rude, and sometimes his temper went up and down and so on. And what I believe happened, that in late 1985, or around there, you also have to see the other players around this. One of them were Ebbe Carlsson, which was a book publisher officially, but there's a lot that points to him being one of the highest one up in the Swedish Stay Behind movement, directly under the control of the headquarters in Brussels, because this guy, Ebbe Carlsson, he could get prime ministers out of their bed at night and get them to do stuff. And when he came in, everybody went into attention. He was a close friend of Olof Palme. He was seen in his office, you know, lying in his sofa. They were having a good time. And also, quite a few times, Ebbe Carlsson and Olof Palme were traveling together. And most of the time, they shared hotel room, which is a bit odd when you think of it, because Ebbe Carlsson was an open homosexual and later died of AIDS. Another one of these people that are very much involved in this is Hans Holmér, which was a very close friend to Ebbe Carlsson. And these two worked together for many years. They were Hans Holmér used to be the chief of the Swedish security police, Säpo. And he used Ebbe Carlsson in many different, when there were scandals around, or when, for instance, there was a big scandal about that people working at a hospital in Gothenburg had been under surveillance and their political views had been registered and so on. The people going down there and clearing everything, clearing out the mess, was Ebbe Carlsson and Hans Holmér. Also, when many of these parties were arranged, it was Ebbe Carlsson who arranged them. And in my opinion, what they did was just like with J. Edgar Hoover. They were collecting evidence against people who went to these parties so that they could blackmail them afterwards. I think that is one of the reasons also why this blackout and cover up and total silence that are still there to this very day is because people who are in a position where they could make a difference if they spoke out know that these people, that there are evidence against them, they've got them by the balls, and because of that they don't know the details of the conspiracy itself, but they do know that if they say anything, boom, they will go down.
Yeah.
And Hans Holmér, according to people in the Swedish Säpo as well, I've learned afterwards, he later died of a disease that was closely related to AIDS. The word AIDS was not mentioned, but it was something that had to do with the immune system, deficiency of the immune system, which is could have to do with HIV AIDS. So these people, and Hans Holmér was also said to be bisexual. So we're talking about two people arranging or being part of these sex parties, both of them dying of AIDS or something related to a similar type of thing. I'm speculating now, but hear me out, okay?
Yep.
We also have another key person who was this ambassador called Lidbom. He was the advisor of Olof Palme for quite a few years, and also his follower, Ingvar Carlsson. And this man was a very manipulative person, very, very highly intelligent, but also involved around this conspiracy in many different roles. He popped up in so many different aspects around this. And I don't know if you've seen, have you seen this comedy called Yes, Mr. Prime Minister?
Actually, I've never seen that, no, but I've heard about it.
Okay, I think that is quite spot on when it comes to this one. You got this very clever advisor to a prime minister that was doing the talking and doing the being the front figure, but a lot of the thinking was done by the other guy. And this is, I think, what was the part of Carl Lidbom.
The Grima Wormtongue, as they call him, the character in Lord of the Rings.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, if we go back to 1986 when this happened, AIDS was a disease that had just come forward, and there was a massive fear around it. There was this scandal that it was only homosexuals that lived a very so-called dirty life, you know, with lots of sexual partners. There was so much shame around this disease. And Rock Hudson had just become the first celebrity that had come forward saying officially that he had this disease, and it was a big scandal all over the world. So it was something that you wanted to avoid as much as you could. What I think happened was that in one of these discreet sex parties where Palme was invited to, somehow he as well got infected with this dreaded disease. I built this on quite a few. He had a disease, a virus disease, that he was going to get treated. He was going to a regular treatment for that. Also, the doctor that treated him, when asked about this, he avoided answering. The question wasn't directly about AIDS, but it was towards going that way, and he avoided, but in a very strange way, he avoided answering it. And then he died just a few weeks later, this doctor. But he confirmed that Palme went there to get all of these treatments for this thing. Also, I just wanted to go back to that one time in Olof Palme went on a tour in Norway. And when he was at the hotel, he was robbed by two prostitutes. This was never published, I think, in Swedish newspaper, but it was a big deal in Norway. He was robbed by two prostitutes. I think they took his clothes, as far as I know, they took his pants and his wallet. So he had a bit of a problem getting back to Sweden. But the thing was that these two prostitutes, according to Dagens Nyheter's journalist Ulla Alsén, were male prostitutes. So here we are again, pointing towards that Olof Palme was bisexual as well.
Yeah.
Okay, so to make all of these things make sense, here is what I would like to suggest. I think that somewhere in the fall of 1985, it has started to go down a bit for the Social Democrats in Sweden anyway, and his career was going a little downhill. At the same time, he was also being attacked with different scandals, tax scandals and so on, and was losing followers, and he was not in a good space. When he was suddenly hit by the worst news of his life, that he had gotten infected by HIV as well.
Yep.
So suddenly, the Social Democrat Party and Olof Palme is in a situation where within a few months, this disease will start showing itself. I mean, you've seen people with this dreaded disease. You see it in their face. People get really skinny and you can spot it right away. So suddenly they are in this very, very difficult situation. There are two options. There's one option is to go out openly with it, that Olof Palme, yes, bisexual, yes, he's got AIDS, yes, he's dying, and so on. This would totally destroy his whole, his whole life work, whatever you call it, the everything he had worked for. It would also destroy the Social Democrat Party. That would just go downhill because there was just too much shame connected with this disease that it would just could destroy the Social Democrat Party. And so on. So, in this difficult situation, Carl Lidbom, his advisor, came up with a plan. Forget about option one. Let's not talk about this openly at all. Instead, what we could do, if we set up an assassination, he looked at the Kennedy assassination, seeing that as soon as the shots were fired and Kennedy died, he got angel wings. From just being an ordinary president, he became a legend. He became the hero. He became, well, somebody untouchable. You could never say anything bad about Kennedy and so on.
Yeah.
So he said, listen, if we do it like this, if we arrange a hit on you, not a real one, but a fake assassination where you will be murdered by a lone assassin. At that very second you die there, you will turn into a legend. Everything you have worked for, everything you have lived for, your name will forever be surrounded with glory and illuminated and everything. You know? So yeah. The two options are total shame and destruction or a fake assassination. And as far as I understood, it took a while for Olof Palme to accept this, but when he talked it through with his family and so on, but I mean the option was quite clear that the fake one would be the way to go. So what they did, sorry?
Yeah, I just want to say as well, and what people need to keep in mind, I think, is that there is a whole, a massive propaganda machine behind the Social Democratic Party at this stage as well. I mean, this is a country, or this is a, well, a country as well, but this is a party that has held the country in its iron grip since basically the dawn of the political system came to Sweden, for Christ's sake. They've been like, it's one of the longest, ruling parties, I think, in the world of actually. It's just been, with brief interludes, they've been out of power. But it's a massive propaganda machine. And obviously, Ulla, they're not going to let their control go this easy. They're going to try to use this to their advantage, just as you're saying here, just as you're arguing for.
Once again, Henry, spot on. I totally agree with you there. And so what they came up with, a plan where it was extremely important that this truth would never come out. So what they needed to was to hire real assassins that thought that they were actually killing him. Because if they had their own faked assassination team, it would come out, people would be able to track them down, and then it would point right at Olof Palme and the center of power here. So what they needed was to hire a team that would do it, but with fake ammo. The team would not know it. So Olof Palme put together, he and Carl Lidbom called in Hans Holmér, which they had mentioned him before. He was the former chief of the security police in Sweden, together with Ebbe Carlsson. These four were put together. And they worked out a plan on how to do this. So the plan was that the task to do this assassination was sent to the South African Colonel Craig Williamson, who was not aware of that it came from Olof Palme himself. He thought that it was a hit. And
A real one, for sure.
But in this pyramid of power, the order comes down from the top of the pyramid many times, and the people who receive the orders have often no idea who is the real person behind it. They just receive the order, they receive the funds and the instructions, and that is. And since they're military and military intelligence and so on, they just follow orders. So I think that I dare almost say that through the banker Peter Wallenberg, who was earliest located in South Africa for many years, the order went through him to Craig Williamson. This I'm not sure about, but this is what I think. Anyway, so Craig Williamson, he had his headquarters was just outside Johannesburg at a little farm called Daisy Farm, where they, for during 2 or 3 months, they prepared this whole assassination. And he put together a team of assassins from different countries. Like I mentioned before, he had his own people, like Anthony White, the Rhodesian elite soldier. He had Rian Stander, which was a colleague of his from Daisy Farm, involved with BOS, the South African secret police, and so on. Very violent people. There was another one. he used as a Norwegian mercenary called Ole Christian Olstad. He also used a West German man who worked for BOS as well, His name was Franz Esser. He was one of the drivers. There was another West German guy called Heine Hiemann, who was based in Sweden as a silent or sleeping agent. He was located in Björklinge, not far from Uppsala, where he was officially a car mechanic. But it was his name, his house in Björklinge, that was later used as a hideout for the shooter after the days after the shooting, and then before he was taken out with diplomatic papers on an airplane flown to, I think, London first and then Turkey afterwards. You had Michael Vernon Townley, who was he was directly connected with Operation 40 that I mentioned before,
yep.
Which was directly involved in the JFK assassination. And under his control in that group was also Roberto Tieme and Julio Izquierdo. The last one was a Basquian Spanish guy, and Roberto Tieme was Argentinian. These people are still around. Then you have Stefano Della Chiaia, who was one of Michael Townley's best friends, and who was this king of rain, this man who also used to work with Klaus Barbier, you know, the
Nazi?
Yeah, the monster from Lyon.
And Barbie, yeah.
They're involved with extreme Nazis, and these people have been used by Franco and other dictators, been sent right, left, and center, killing people in South Africa, Argentina, all the South American countries, and done hits in Washington and in Europe and so on. Then also you have the guy who did the shooting himself, who was a Kurdish Turk, but from Kurdistan, who used to work for the Iranian secret SAVAK, the secret police, and he was educated there or did his military career there to start with. And then after that, he's been used as a professional assassin. I'm not sure if I forgot anyone, but
it's a good gang there anyway. There,
it's a good gang anyway. So Craig Williamson put this hit team together.
Yeah,
and the whole thing was that it was made up with one spider in the whole web, and his name was Carl Gustav Östling. He was a right wing Nazi, policeman who used to be part of the baseball gang in Stockholm. A very, very violent gang that was initiated by Hans Holmér, surprise, surprise, some years before the assassination. And their task was to clear the streets of what they call scum, you know, beat the shit out of people, drug addicts and whoever didn't fit in, just beat them. And they even managed to kill at least one person in a subway station.
Let me ask you this before you continue here. Yeah. If this also is if this is partially something that's created, well, I know we talk about the double agent thing as well, but on top of this, there is the whole political game going as well. So yeah. Do you think that they wanted also to make this look, if for those, let's say, few journalists or, you know, obviously this is many at the time, and they know that there will be investigations surrounding this case. No matter what we do, there'll be tons of people asking questions and they want to know what's going on and all this. So my question to you is, do you think that they also wanted to make this look then like there is a really powerful right-wing network working behind the scenes, partially responsible or solely responsible for the assassination, since this is also at the same time we're talking about the you know, the image, if you will, of a really powerful social democratic hero that they're trying to create here. What do you think, Ulla?
I'm not really sure I understood the question.
All right, let me see if I can simplify it. Do you think that they want this to look also in the for those few journalists to look into this case and realize soon enough that, yep, it's completely right. There's a right-wing network behind the assassination. But what I'm getting at, do you also think that they consciously chose these people to be part of the operation because they want it to look like it's a right-wing network behind the assassination. Do you see what I'm saying? Because there is
I see what you're saying, but I don't think that at all. Because I think the reason they use these people are because these are the people violent enough and disciplined enough and good enough and experienced to do these type of things. They try to do everything to avoid that this should come out in the open.
Yeah, sure. I got you.
Okay, so what we got now is like what Östling, Carl Gustav Östling, this right-wing policeman, he was also very, very high up and involved, as far as I know, in Stay Behind as well, because he was also the weapons expert for the whole Swedish police force. He was helping out to pick out what gun the Swedish police force should use and so on. And his task in all of this was to play a double agent. He was the one that should welcome and put together the assassination and help them get in position and everything, and with all the logistics, with weapons, with housing, all of these things. That he was his task with his right-wing police colleagues and so on to take part of that. But also, he was the only one that knew that the ammunition supplied would not be real. So he supplied the weapons, he supplied all of these things, and when they practiced with real guns or real ammo, but for the actual hit, the ammo was exchanged by blanks or like paintball type of things.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
That was the plan. Okay, so now we have a hit team put together, and if I can call them, if I can call that Plan A, that this group is killing Olof Palme on his own orders, that is Plan A, because soon we will have to look at Plan B as well, because there's even one more layer to this this whole conspiracy. Anyway, so Plan A joined in Sweden. They meet up in Sweden. Craig Williamson meets the Norwegian mercenary in a restaurant in Stockholm, and they exchange money and stuff like that. The three people together with Craig Williamson are flown out from South Africa with Luxair to Luxembourg. In Luxembourg, they're met by Franz Esser in a Winnebago type of car, driven up through Germany, and then they go in to Sweden through Denmark and Helsingborg, that way over across. They come into Sweden and they stay to start with. They more or less camp, even though it was in the middle of the winter, but in small little houses and so on, not to attract any attention. Later they were moved into Stockholm and then moved around in small hotels and apartments and so on. So the other ones are flowing in afterwards from different, Stefano Della Chiai. He was flown in under the name of Henri Verlier in a private plane. And like I say, Heine Hymann was already there and so on. And they were met up and helped by most of the people involved in this baseball gang, who was a small group. There were only about 8 or 10 of them, but very, very disciplined, very hard, violent people who helped to assist them with everything needed. These people are also the ones that pops up like walkie-talkie men and so on later in the assassination itself. They are in all the key positions. They're in the communication center where the alarm goes. They're the ones delaying everything. They want people driving the ambulance, delaying that. They're the first police cars coming to the assassination site. They're the ones running after the murder. They are part of the cars stopping stopping normal people from getting involved and so on. And later also people from the same baseball gang are Hans Holmér's bodyguards. So here we have once again very strange that people who are being pointed out as being part of the assassination also pops up as part of the investigation, you know, because they were in the Palmer room where these things were discussed and so on. Östling that was pointed out as being a key person in all this. He was sitting in the Palmer room next to Hans Holmér many times also. Anyway, so we have plan A. The people are now in place in Stockholm, around there, and they start for like 6 weeks. They keep Olof Palme under surveillance, having no idea that he is aware of them. You have all these observations of people with walkie-talkies and so on that starts popping up around Palme's, where he lives, around the Social Democrats' headquarters, around the parliament and so on. So during these weeks, they are trying to make a clear picture of where to hit him, the best place.
And I wanted to ask you as well, we might get there, of course, if you're trying to walk us through, you know, how it, the event took place, or the assassination took place, the fake one, obviously. But I remember we, way back in our series, probably in the first couple of shows we did there, Ulla, we talked about some of the strange, you know, bullets that were found at the crime scenes. Yeah. And we, you know, we wanted to get to some of the, you know, potential planted evidence and stuff like that. Are we getting there in the chronology, if you will?
We are getting there slowly, okay. Slowly.
Yeah, no worries. Take your time.
No, also, in the meantime, while this is happening, Olof Palme himself, he knows that he's only got like a few months left to live officially. You know, the plan is that when this fake assassination is done, he will be taken out with an ambulance, driven out to an airport, and then flown out of Sweden while a double has been shot and taken to the hospital. He's flown, secretly flown out, and then the plan is for him to spend the last time of his life in one of the big castles owned by the elite, I think most probably in Switzerland or France, at least to start with. That was the plan. A small, operation, facial operation and so on. And then the best treatment possible for his disease and so on. That was the whole thing, that he could live the rest of his life in luxury and quiet and peace, and that his family could come from Sweden and visit him and so on.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And during the last few months, what he is totally focused on is to clear his name, you know, so that once he's dead, no one will be able to dig up any dirt that could be traced back to him, and that also could unravel this whole scandal. So this is when he starts getting really not interested, you know, in all of these meetings that his colleagues say he was just sitting staring out of the window.
Yeah.
When Kjell Olof Feldt, the Minister of Finance, was talking to him, he was totally not there. He was, you know, like playing the flute and just saying, you get on with it, I don't care.
Yeah. Remember I told you about that scene when this is a testimony by the financial minister, or whatever you want to call him at the time. He talks just about this in terms of one of the biggest overhauls of the banking system, the economy in Sweden at the time. And this is, of course, how the government, with the aid of the central bank, managed to crash the whole Swedish economy to use it in consequent ways of you know getting wealth out from under the people and all that. But nonetheless, this champion of the people, the social democratic, you know, highest hen in the hen house here, is like not doing nothing about this. You know, why is this? It's so strange. His behavior is very, very odd.
Exactly. He's not there. He's not interested at all, because he knows he's already moving on. But what he does is, I think he's. There's a lot of evidence shredded, you know, lots of papers being destroyed and so on. And also, he starts canceling illegal arms deals, you know, illegal mm-hmm. arms transport, which is really pissing a lot of people off, because suddenly this whole system of illegal arms that are being transported left, right and center, he stops it. He stops several of these transports, deliveries of gunpowder and missiles and so on. And the elite that he used to be loyal to are sitting like, what is going on with this guy? What is happening? They don't know the truth about his behavior. They just start seeing, this guy is not reliable anymore. You know, what is going on?
Mm.
And he keeps doing that in many different areas. Also, as far as he gives away Sweden's right to the North Sea oil, he deals with Rajiv Gandhi, which is and make one of the biggest arms deals in Swedish history. But there's many different big questions marks around this whole thing. As you remember, Rajiv Gandhi also got murdered later on.
Mm.
Like most people who are involved in around these big conspiracies, they have a bad habit of dying young.
Yeah.
Anyway, so the banking elite and NATO are getting very worried, especially since also he's planning to do a trip to Moscow to meet Gorbachev. And lots of people, especially military and right-wing people, are very worried that since he behaves so strangely, he will become a traitor. He will give away Sweden to the Russians.
Sure, we'll merge into the Soviet Union, no problem. Do whatever you want.
And one of the things, he signs an order saying that this, should Sweden be invaded, the Swedish police and, no, the Swedish military have to stand down and sort of become loyal to the invaders.
Does he have this much power? That's ridiculous. Is this true?
And it really, you know, people got so, so upset. So what happened was that there was a meeting, a secret meeting in Wiltshire in England, where the top of NATO and many people from Stay Behind, bankers, politicians, and so on, met up there. And the thing was, what they were discussing was like, we have to stop this guy. He's mad. We can't trust him anymore. So what they come up with is a plan to make an assassination on him, you know, to assassinate him. So now we have two plans. Plan A, which is Palme's own assassination, and Plan B, which is ordered by NATO. There have been documents leaking out from this meeting and so on, showing exactly what was decided and so on, that they wanted to get rid of him. And Plan B, the NATO part, have decided to eliminate him as well. But while they do this, while they start planning it, they discover, I'm not sure how they got hold of information, but they find out that there's Plan A is actually already there staging this killing. So what they do, Plan B decides to, let's be on standby, let's hide in the shadows, sort of, so to speak. Let Plan A do the assassination and they can take the blame. Should they fail, we go in and finish the job and then blame it on Plan A anyway, which is a perfect plan for them.
Yeah,
they get rid of him and they're not involved. So now suddenly there are two teams that are after the same victim. Okay. So I hope it's not too confusing. Here.
No, definitely not. I think Ulla, what we're going to do here is it's a good opportunity and good to take a little pause here between the segments at this point. And basically, all I want to do is I want to push your pause button pretty much here.